This afternoon, we're visiting with Dr. Cynthia Orozco. She's a professor of humanities. History and humanities at Eastern New Mexico University in Ruidoso.
That's right. And I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you very much. And despite the fact that you've made a home in southeastern New Mexico, you are a Tejana.
I sure am. I'm from Cuero, Texas, home of the Fighting Gobblers. also, I consider Austin, San Antonio, and Houston also to be part home.
Tell us what the topic is for your presentation. When we hear this on the radio later today, you already have spoken. This is going to be broadcast during the 5 p.m. hour. So what was the topic of your presentation here at A&M Commerce?
My topic was on Adela Slaus Vento, a major Mexican-American civil rights activist from the 1920s all the way till 1990. And she was from San Juan in Edinburgh, Texas.
And that's down in the Rio Grande Valley.
Yes.
The lower Rio Grande Valley.
That's in the valley. Her name, Slaus, is of German descent, but Germans who were Mexicanized in Mexico. And she married a man with the last name Vento, which is of Italian origin, but also Mexicanized in Mexico. And she was a major writer of letters to the editor and columns for Spanish and English newspapers in South Texas all of her life. She would respond to the issues of the time, whether it was an attempt to get a law passed in the 1940s at the state legislature that would have prohibited racial segregation against persons of Mexican descent. She also wrote quite a bit about the Bracero program, a work-labor agreement between the U.S. and Mexico between 1942 and 65, related to the beginning of World War II. And she was against the exploitation of workers, particularly farm workers.
What was her view on the Bracero program? Because it was a very complicated program. What was her focus in trying to influence policy around that program?
What she did is she wrote both U.S. presidents and presidents in Mexico, explaining to them that the program was super exploitative. In other words, the wages were way, way too low, and nobody was paying attention to the actual wages workers were being paid. She also noted the consequence that the braceros had on the Tejanos, people who were native to Texas, that they could not compete with the cheap labor that braceros were forced to take, and therefore they ended up migrating to North Texas and other parts of the United States.
Was there a degree of personal risk that she exposed herself to by being so publicly vocal on these issues?
Yes, there is reference in some of her materials to being threatened and insulted. We don't have more detail on that. We also know that she personally was victimized by the segregation and racist attitudes of the day. For example, when she graduated, which was highly unusual, from high school in the 1920s, her classmates explained to her or told her they couldn't believe she had graduated because she was a foreigner, and of course she was from here. Also, she and her family could not rent a lot, a property lot in Corpus for a short time because they were of Mexican descent, and she too was degraded by exclusion at various restaurants in the valley, being a Mexican American.
A lot of people from this part of the state have never been down there. Perhaps people might have been to San Antonio on vacation or gone to Corpus Christi or something. But as far as being in the smaller towns in South Texas, not everyone in this part of the state has been down there.
Yes.
And of course, we're talking about South Texas more than half a century ago. So could you please paint a brief picture of the context? What were these communities like? What were the economic forces and the social forces that were affecting the situation down there back then?
Okay. Well, let's set up the political context first. And we should note that between, let's say, the years 1910 and 1950, there would have been three Tejanos only who served in the legislature and not state legislature, and not even at the same time. For example, J.T. Canales from Brownsville, who was a millionaire, was called the greaser from Brownsville on the House floor in the Texas legislature in 1911. So there was that unfortunate racial attitude at the time that persisted really until the 60s or so. So politically, that was a problem. The poll tax, of course, was in place until 1964-65 with federal legislation. That was another problem. There were also white primaries in some of the counties. That was an additional problem. Economically, we really did not have, definitely not an upper class. The middle class was small. You had a handful of lawyers, many merchant small business people who would have constituted the LULAC organization, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the oldest and largest Hispanic civil rights organization in the country, which was founded in Corpus in 1929.
What is a white primary?
The white primaries were the events that were held before the general election where only persons who were considered Caucasian could participate.
So as far as the segregation, what we really had in that part of Texas was an equivalent of Jim Crow with...
Yes, yes. And actually, we sometimes call it Jaime Crow. Jaime means Jim in Spanish. But yes, most people, most Texans are unaware of the fact that Jim Crow also existed against persons of Mexican descent. They think it's a black and white issue. But definitely, and it was throughout Texas. Most importantly... Many, probably a third to a half of the schools would have been segregated. There would have been a tripart system with African American, Mexican, and white schools. And again, it varied depending on where you were, but that was something also that Slos Vento was against.
Your research and your work is part of an overall pattern that has been continuing in recent decades of reclaiming lost histories,
yes.
Discovering lost histories.
Yes.
So could you talk a little bit about the context of your work and what's going on in your field as far as either dusting off stories that had been neglected or perhaps finding new stories that had not even been told yet,
yes.
Regarding these struggles?
Okay. Well, I was a sophomore at the University of Texas in Austin in 1978. And we barely had the first full-time Tejano historian at that time. So there were decades and decades where nobody was writing. The professional historians didn't exist. Professional Chicano history archives really didn't start to exist until the 1970s. So a lot of history was lost, and definitely the oral history was lost. But anyway, when I started, there was no Adela Slos archive in the library. I was fortunate to meet her. Her son was a professor of Spanish at UT Austin, and she shared some of her archives. However, she did not tell me that she too was a major activist and simply continued to promote the male leaders and the organization in general. So many, many years later, about 40 years later, I found out that she had a major archive that had not been shared with me. So her son and I started a project. He now has completed a book on her, and mine will be out maybe in about a year and a half.
And so what's going to happen with those primary source documents?
Well, her son is a professor of Spanish. He's trying to decide which archive to place them into. I might mention that there was no LULAC archive, and it was an English-speaking organization, middle-class leadership. Those papers did not get to the library until 1980. Of course, there's still papers out there that are not there yet. Preservation of historic papers are very important.
So we're not certain where it's going to end up. It might be at UT. Might it end up at Eastern New Mexico?
Her work was mostly in the Valley. So I hope that they do remain in Texas. It's up to the son. Sometimes people will put papers where somebody might pay them for them. She's actually at that level that her papers are of national significance, and or people put them where they might get used or where they are regionally significant.
So what's in your book? What if you could just kind of give a thumbnail sketch,
yes.
of what's in this book?
Yes. Okay, so the first thing the book does is places Adela Slos Vento in the context of South Texas. from the 1920s to 1963. That's the period that we refer to as the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement in Texas, with the LULAC organization after 1929 playing the major role for civil rights and a legal challenge of segregation. Then I addressed what we call the Chicano movement, which would have been from 1963 to 1978, where we see youth and students and more radical measures, marches, walkouts, that kind of thing. She's also active in that as a writer. And then I talk about her as a public intellectual because she wrote a significant body of letters to the editors and op-eds for newspapers, Spanish and English, mostly in San Antonio and the Valley over the decades. I also address her as a woman in the context of a male-dominated movement. LULAC had separate chapters for women, separate chapters for men. She chose to participate in neither and mostly did her writing outside of her home. She was also a mother, a wife, and a jail matron, so she had a full-time job. But nevertheless, she felt it was her duty and obligation to speak out on racial discrimination and exploitation of workers.
How was the transition between that civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s into the Chicano movement of the 70s? I mean, I'm sure that in some ways it might have been seamless, and I'm sure that in other ways it might have been very difficult and in some ways contentious. So how did that work?
Well, basically, the first group or cohort of civil rights activists in the 20s were World War I vets, and they were successful in creating LULAC in 1929. Many of those vets could not get a cup of coffee when they came back. As we're moving across time, LULAC continues to be significant. It has numerous chapters. It has chapters in Dallas, Houston, and actually quite a number of small towns as well, including Cueto, my own, in 1940. Those councils came and go, sometimes under threat of members and lack of resources, etc. But anyway, bottom line is that as things began to change, the Mexican-American youth were impacted by national events. They were impacted by the African-American Civil Rights Movement. The rise of Dr. King eventually changed to the rise of people like Malcolm X, and therefore youth were invigorated by this. Also, the Raza Unida Party was a separate party to get Mexican-American elected officials, arose in 1963 in Crystal City. The student walkouts were also part of this. And a greater appreciation for the Spanish language and Mexican culture versus attempts to more so Americanize. Those were the new threads of the new movement.
As far as younger people in their late teens and 20s and perhaps 30s who are undergraduates and grad students at universities today, what would you like for them to know about the history of these civil rights movements in Texas, specifically, you know, in the Chicano communities?
Okay. Mostly I would like people to know about the disadvantages that existed in previous generations and to not take our privileges for granted that we have today. And also, I would hope that some of these activities and activism of people like Adelis Las Vento provide and serve as a role model for young people who sometimes feel like they don't have a voice. Everybody has a voice. We can choose to use our voice. We can choose to do so in independent and free ways. And she had everything going against her. And nonetheless, she proved to be a major leader across decades.
With regard specifically to women's issues, have you ever spoken with a student who was surprised at either the degree to which women were disadvantaged or how recent in history it was when certain restrictions and conditions were in effect?
Yes. In fact, talking to some of the members of the Hispanic student organization here on campus today, I'm surprised to learn that most of them have never heard of any of the women that I mentioned today. We need to continue to integrate our Texas history with all kinds of voices that exist out there, the historical voices that have been persons of Mexican descent, women, lesbians, all kinds of people that we need to have this history about.
We need to wind up in a little bit, and there's a couple of other things not directly related to this that I want to ask about before we're done. But before we move on from the topic specifically, your presentation today, your most recent book, is there anything that we've left out that is important that you'd like for people to know about, or any questions you might have for people, you know, to pass along?
I want people to know, especially about the Handbook of Texas. Our professor here, Dr. Jessica, and help me with Jessica's last name, I never know how to say, Ranowski, is heading a project called the Handbook of Texas Women. This is a wonderful opportunity to write about and insert the names of key women in Texas history into, and so we want to thank her for that project and ask people to contact her if they know names of people who should be included in the project. We want to continue to encourage the Hispanic community in this area, particularly the students, to continue to seek out more things that should be available here at this campus. I understand that the Hispanic population is about 7%. But again, Hispanics are highly significant in number in Texas, and this university can continue to take an interest in the history and culture of the Hispanic community as well.
Now, when did you leave Texas and go to New Mexico?
I went to New Mexico, it must have been around 1994. So I had, I taught at UT San Antonio. I also worked at the Institute of Texan Cultures in San Antonio. And I went to New Mexico to learn about how and why there were five national presidents from New Mexico and LULAC in the 30s and 40s. So I went there to conduct research, and I ended up marrying in the process, and therefore I've stayed there. But Southeast New Mexico is also called Little Texas. It very much feels like West Texas, and I'm happy to be there.
So you're teaching at the campus there in Ruidoso, and it's my understanding that, among other things, that part of the country is famous for being Billy the Kid's area.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the Lincoln County War occurred there around 1878. Billy the Kid is famous in our community. What many people don't realize is that before the area became the community called Lincoln, it was called La Placita del Rio Bonito, the little plaza on the pretty river. It was a thriving Hispanic community, primarily of subsistence farmers and ranchers. The Lincoln County War virtually destroyed that community, and Lincoln never became a municipality. The town pretty much died, and now it's famous for museums.
And so you mentioned that southeastern New Mexico is very much like West Texas.
Yes.
Culturally.
Yes.
And what is different about that part of the state compared to, say, the central and northern part, where they have more of a colonial heritage?
Well, what you're suggesting is that along the Rio Grande River and Belen and Albuquerque north, we call that northern New Mexico, and it had an early Spanish presence. Actually, Cabeza de Vaca did walk into New Mexico in the 1530s in our area, but the area that I live in is not where we had Spanish colonial settlement. Instead, it was Apache homeland, and because of that, not until Fort Stanton was established in 1855 did we start to get European Americans and Hispanics living there, and that's kind of what gave a different kind of environment to our community.
It's a bit more of a Wild West.
Exactly.
Kind of place.
It's still West, and sometimes it's wild and sometimes it's not so wild.
And that's why they, it's my understanding, that's why they the town of Socorro has its name, is because if you could make it from El Paso
Yes, and you're talking about the trek from El Paso, which was named by Juan de Oñate, and the Spanish's trek through the desert, and the succor and the sorrow of going through desert land in an attempt to move up north.
Pretty difficult, because if you wanted to follow the river, you would have company, but if you wanted to try and avoid the indigenous people and go around the river, then there's no water.
And we still have a vibrant Apache community. The Apaches, when I was living in Texas, I was young and naive. I didn't know that Native Americans still were alive. And of course, I was young and naive. But the Apaches did survive, the Mescalero Apaches. And the Chiricahua joined them, and the Lapan Apaches, who were also from the Corpus area, a few of them ended up in Mescalero. So we have an Apache community. We have a vibrant casino, a racetrack. It's a beautiful area, wonderful fishing, a beautiful community, 7,000 feet above sea level.
And there was also a tragic story about some indigenous people who are not from that part of the state, but who were resettled in southeastern New Mexico at Fort Sumner.
Yes. Okay. And actually, that would have been the Mescalero Apaches, who were rounded up by Kit Carson. And Kit Carson also helped to round up the Navajo, who had a 400-mile walk from the Four Corners area to the Fort Sumner area, which was not native to them at all.
And it's not fertile land. It's very bare, alkaline.
No, and neither the Apaches or the Navajo were farmers. There were attempts to Americanize them, to Christianize them, and make them farmers, but neither were farmers.
And it didn't work out.
And it did not work. It was a temporary reservation. Thereafter, actually, Kit Carson did work to get a separate reservation for the Navajo. They got that, although his name is Mud in Navajo country. Mescalero Reservation was created in 1873. At one time, there were 4,000 Mescalero in our area. After Fort Stanton, there were 400. So up until the 1950s or 60s, it was an unhealthy community. Today, it is a very vibrant and strong community, very healthy.
Well, we're happy to have a little good news to put as a coda at the end of that troubling story of what happened in that part of the state. And the last thing I want to mention or ask you to mention is explaining a little bit about Eastern New Mexico and its various campuses, not Eastern New Mexico this region, but Eastern New Mexico University.
Yes.
We're familiar with that, actually, here at A&M Commerce, because we compete in the same athletic conference.
Okay.
ENMU is in the Lone Star Conference with us, and we play the Greyhounds Zias and everything.
Okay, excellent. Well, we've had Eastern New Mexico University in Portales since the 1930s, which is actually quite surprising. Not just because it was Eastern, but because it was rural and it was a depression. We also have a campus at Roswell that was at a previous air base. And then we have our campus, which is small, but we've had for about almost 30 years now. It's a small little community. We serve a small number of students, about 700. But it's an important place for rural people who would not have access otherwise.
Is it a two-year or four-year campus?
It's a two-year school. Also, folks who do online learning might look into our cybersecurity program. We actually have a wonderful professor named Dr. Stephen Miller, who lives in Corpus but runs a wonderful and very expensive cybersecurity program that you can get completely online.
Wow.
And they pay very well.
Yes, cybersecurity.
And our rates are very, very competitive. So please check it out on the internet.
Dr. Cynthia Orozco from Eastern New Mexico University at Ruidoso.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, and thank you very much for coming to Northeast Texas. You're with listener-supported radio for Northeast Texas. This is 88.9 KETR.